Hello, and welcome to the episode of the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast. I'm your host, Neil Horwitz. You can find me on Twitter, NJ27, also on LinkedIn, where I post more content. The website is dsmsports.net, where you can find every episode and tons more content in the archive. And of course, this podcast is available on whichever podcast platform is your favorite. We have such a good show for you guys today. I was so delighted about this conversation. One of my favorite in all the years I've been doing this podcast is exactly in the intersection that I love to play in. And I think you're going to learn a lot. I know I sure did. My guest on the podcast today is Ben Valenta. He is the SVP of Strategy Analytics for Fox Sports, also the co-author of the book Fans Have More Friends. And we just get into it, man. Like, we talk about the sort of the art and science of understanding fandom. You know, why do fans have more friends, as this book says, and what that means about how to market to them, how to think about fan development, the journey of, you know, a casual observer to become making them a fan, how you develop younger fans, fans across sports. Just such good conversation here. So listen up, stick around, watch all of it, take notes, and watch it again. Here's my conversation with Ben Valenta of Fox Sports. I am back on the podcast with today's guest. I'm so excited to be speaking with him. I mean, hell, we could have recorded the first time we met. It would have been a great podcast. My guest on the podcast today is Ben Valenta. He is the executive vice president of strategy and analytics for Fox Sports, also the co-author of the book Fans Have More Friends. Welcome to the podcast today, Ben.
Thanks for having me, Neil. Looking forward to it.
Hell yeah. So excited for this conversation. Just so many things that intersect with, you know, the areas that I'm interested in, that my audience is interested in. So we're gonna learn a lot today. Before we get in the meat of our discussion, Ben, tell us about you. Give us an idea of your career path, your stops along the way, how you got to what you're doing today, and any tips for folks that kind of want to try to do what you do.
Good question. I started my career in consulting. I did consumer insights and brand strategy work for a couple different agencies. They had a pretty fantastic Rolodex, and we had some really fantastic clients. And I think the beauty of that part of my career was that you would basically just parachute into a new category with a new client or newish client, and to kind of figure out what was happening in the category. And so you get a lot of reps at asking the key question, which is, why do people do what they do?
Yeah.
And I think my career has been spent just asking that question and trying to seek answers to that question. And so I spent about 12 or so years working in that consumer insights brand strategy space. Naturally, kind of found my way into sort of repeat business with clients in the media space, in the sports space, teams and leagues, and then also like in the sports media space specifically. And eventually, some of my clients landed at Fox Sports. And they hired me as a consultant for a little while until a position opened up that just kind of brought that capability in-house. And so now I have been at Fox for about 10 years. And really, the crux of the job is answering that question: why do people do what they do? And in this context, it's why do fans do what they do? And so I have been seeking answers to that question. And then obviously trying to bring the insights to bear on how we think about the business. And so it gets a little bit more nuanced from there. But I think that's like a pretty easy way to think about my career journey and what I do at Fox now.
And to get a better idea of, you know, like how are the insights that you uncover get implemented into, like, what's the action that gets taken, or what are you trying to uncover in your remit with Fox Sports?
It would be really easy if there were a ton of examples in answer to that question that were very linear. Whereas like we did X,
Yeah, we found it. Get
and
it.
then we found X, and then we did Y. And the reality is that I think this job is requires curiosity. It's an iterative job, so you don't just like solve a problem. You over time, with experience and repetition, develop a point of view. And then really the job becomes, can you bring that point of view to bear? Can you communicate that point of view internally in ways that help the organization make decisions, do things that sort of conducts the business more efficiently, more effectively, whatever that might be? So, when my old world as a consultant, the easiest way to think about the answer to that question would be like, you would come up with some sort of insight, and there'd be a campaign, like an ad campaign. You could point to like, there's this tangible thing that we did. Our insights, our work, our positioning recommendations went into the formation of that campaign, and here you can see it now on your TV screen or on your mobile device. Now it's a little bit more diffuse. It's a little bit more intangible, right? So we're just sort of shaping how the organization thinks about the consumer, the fan, And then we put that in a variety of contexts. So we could be thinking about that from a sales perspective, from a production perspective, from a marketing perspective, from a communications perspective. At the end of the day, I think really what the job is, like another way to think about it, is we take that the answer to that question, why people do what they do, and then we advocate for the fans. And that's really what the job is. We sort of
Yeah.
represent that voice
You're like
internally.
the voice of the fan. We've heard that term thrown around a little bit over the years.
That's right.
That's awesome. And so, I mean, in that sense, though, like, how do you know, or how do you try to track, like, what we said did actually did play out the way that we thought it would, based on our insights? Or like, are there times when you guys don't necessarily know, how do you know you're doing a good job, I guess?
I mean, I think you just, one, you just have to remain relentlessly curious about the space, right? Like, I have a pretty well-founded point of view around how fandom works, why fans engage. Are there blind spots? I bet there are. And I think that I at least approach the job as if there are. I think we get, you can get to a dangerous place where you know that you have the right answer. You become blind to new information. So we practice and preach just that relentless curiosity. We constantly challenge the priors. We are constantly looking to poke holes and advance the way we're thinking about the space, the fans, the category, how people engage with media. I mean, I think we're trying to just sort of constantly pull at the same threads. And again, I come back to this word all the time. My team gets tired of hearing me say it, but we iterate. One thing I've come to learn about any of this is I used to work in a project-based world, and you would get a project with a specific objective, and then you go solve the objective. And anymore, I am convinced that there is no way to solve the objective, to answer the question in one fell swoop. It really is about iterating and building and getting smarter and refining and removing what didn't work and getting to a sharper, clearer distillation of the answer. And so I think that that's really what we try and do here. And that just takes time. Like that, you have to sort of like, you get good through repetition and you build that muscle. And I think that's really what we're trying to do is sort of build that muscle so that we can be smarter. It doesn't come back to, answer your question of like, how do we know we're doing a good job? I think we just have to make sure that we are constantly challenging ourselves to think about things differently, but also to just have the courage of our convictions to say.
So we'll get into this, like, some of the weeds of frameworks and philosophy and all that, because I definitely want to dive deep. And of course, you have as well in the book, Fans and More Friends. But like, the big picture question, I guess, like, how do you define a fan? And like, is do we throw the word fan? Like, what kind of framework do you use? We throw the word fan around pretty liberally, I think. Like, if someone is like, not everyone is a fanatic. It's short for fanatic. And like, there are viewers, there are consumers, there are fans. So like, what like I guess a that big picture question of like how you define a fan, both in general as well as in the context of your day-to-day work with Fox Sports. And what kind of framework do you use to sort of think about the whatever types of fans or cohorts or however you think about it?
This is a really good question. It's really important, I think, to the beginning any conversation around fandom with a clear definition of what we're actually talking about. What is this behavior in question? So I think the typical way people think about this in the industry is fandom is about passion. And so it's usually defined on some sort of like, in terms of like methodology, it can be defined on like an avidity scale. So you ask, hey Neil, you say you're a hockey fan. Rate yourself. How big of a hockey fan you are you on a scale of from 1 to 10 or 1 to 6 or whatever it might be? That's an important piece of it. So it's not that we want to sort of disregard that entirely, but what we have found over time, and again, we're iterating on things, is that it was kind of a half measure. And so what you would have, because this is a very subjective review of your own definition of fandom and passion and avidity, what you would find is you'd recruit, let's say, a focus group of fans. And they would come into the room, and you could instantly tell that they were not fans because they'd say, oh, I'm a huge fan of the Anaheim Mighty Ducks. And you'd say, all right, well, who's the starting center? Right? Like, who's the goaltender? And they wouldn't be able to answer the question. They wouldn't be able to do things that fans can and should be able to do. And so I think what we've done is develop over time a methodology that takes into account two things: passion, so that, do you rate yourself as a passionate fan? But then, if you say yes, what are the actions that you take as a result of that passion? What do you do that fans do that then we can corroborate effectively that what that that passion rating is true? right? So do you watch games? Do you go to games? Do you buy and wear merch? Do you know who's on the team, right? Do you post about this? Do you follow accounts related to this? Do you bet? Do you play fantasy? Do you talk to your friends about this sort of stuff? Have you ever called into a sports talk radio show, right? Like, how many podcasts do you listen to? So if someone says, "Hey, I'm a really big fan. I'm a passionate fan, and I also do all these things that fans do. You know, I'm a season ticket holder. I watch most, 80% of the games on TV, so on and so forth down the line." Then we can effectively say, "Okay, you're an engaged fan, right?" And so that's how we think about fandom. Fandom is passion plus action, and that's how we measure it. And then what we've done is very simple. So we've developed what we call a value score. And really what it is just like a spectrum of engagement. And so a lot of people will preach very detailed consumer segmentations, and they'll say, okay, this type of fan is they behave this way, and so we're going to call them some sort of pithy name. All we do is we separate people by the level of their engagement. So there are people who are more engaged, we call them high value fans. There are people who are less engaged, we call them mid value fans. There are people who are kind of on the periphery, low value fans, and there are people who are not fans. And we just really think about the world in those four buckets. And I think that simplistic understanding of the fan universe has really helped unlock a lot of insights, especially quantitatively, because we can see clear patterns emerge in the data when we're very effectively and accurately pulling people apart and putting them into the appropriate buckets.
Oh, I freaking love this. I'm already excited. How do you then think about those fan journeys? I assume they're probably not all equal. They're not all uniform. But when you're thinking about we're talking right now, of course, during the World Cup, and there's a lot of people who are gonna say they're diehard fans, and they maybe can name one player on one team, perhaps, or if that. And so how do you then start to think about moving those fans up the spectrum? Maybe not to turn them into diehard soccer fans, but just, I guess, more generally, if you are trying to cultivate fans of college football, fans of X team, fans of a league or a TV program, what are those high value jumps from, the non-fan to the low value fan? And even the types of things that do result in a step jump, I guess. Things that are like, oh, if we get them into this, if we get them to whatever, play a fantasy a team, whatever, then that's gonna make them move up a lot more versus them buying some merch or whatever. What do those steps look like, and how do we get someone to move up the fan spectrum?
Yeah, I think that this is where we kind of get into this. We go some sort of like a framework for how we understand the category and the consumer, and we really get into our sort of understanding, our point of view on how fandom works. So, in my view, fandom is it's a belonging engine. It's really about the connection that the team, the league, the game can facilitate with other people. And so again, in my view, the only way for someone to come into this world and then eventually end up as that passionate, avid, engaged, high-value fan is because so many of their social connections, their relationships, their interactions with the outside world are facilitated by that team, league, game. And so that's really the answer
That's
to
the
the
crux.
question is there really isn't any. So there are activities, there are interventions, you could call it. There are tactics, if you want to think about it from a marketing lens, that can help facilitate those connections. But the connections are the most important thing. And I think if you're talking about like growing fandom, whether that be like you want to establish the next generation of fans with a younger audience, or you want to try and get those people to take a few steps further down the sort of like the passion engagement scale, the fan value scale. It really all comes down to the social networks that they have that are activated by this thing. And so when you have someone who, maybe another way to say this that might be clear, when you have someone whose fandom is growing, what you will find motivating that growth is a web of social activity. And if you find someone whose fandom is waning, they are becoming less engaged over time, what you will find on the other side of that is a fraying social network. There are fewer people that they have to share this thing with, or that thing has no longer the resonance that it once did. And because they're not sharing it with those people as much, as often, as frequently, as passionately, then they lose interest and they lose urgency. And I think another helpful thing to like, and maybe this is kind of contextual, but it helps to think about this in terms of this is something that happens over time. There is no switch to turn someone from a non-fan to an engaged fan, or from an engaged fan to less of an engaged fan. It just happens over time because it's activated by these social networks. And so I think when we talk about specific tactics you can do to try and motivate fandom, it really all comes down like does this center the experience that this person can have with other people? Is it repeatable? Is it meaningful? Is it easy? Is there less friction to that process? Is it fun? And then what you'll find is that people's fandom will grow, their engagement will grow, their passion will grow.
Super insightful and actionable as well. And like, how do you then think about that in the context of the different forms of fandom, I guess, in the way that someone might become, develop an affinity toward an athlete or toward a sport, especially like now, the like 30 years ago in the 90s or whatever, like when we were thinking about, becoming a sports fan, it meant you follow the team. You cared about who was playing well. You watched the most of the games, and that's still very much a part of being a fan today. But it's not the only way to be a fan today. Now you might just care about like what the WNBA players wearing, wearing in the tunnel when they arrive to the game, or you might really enjoy this person's, Twitch stream, but you don't watch their games, or you might, really like the way that this person talk like is also a Taylor Swift fan or whatever it might be. Like, you have different ways that people come into these fandom ecosystems and atmospheres, and maybe it just depends on what your community of friends are and how you connect around those things, and that's maybe what you would get at anyway. But like, are there Is that is one type of fandom more sticky than another? Is one type of fandom different than another? Or are they all ultimately, there's still something at the core that is, cultivating that fandom, I guess, regardless of whether you actually care about the team's wins and losses?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things you're putting your finger on here that we should kind of maybe pull apart. So one is I think just what's happened over time is that there are just more ways, there's more touch points out there now to connect as a fan. I would argue if someone is only following Caitlin Clark on Instagram to get the tunnel check, fit check, that they're not actually a fan. That's not, it is fan behavior. It is an activity that fans do, but in and of itself, by itself, if it's the only thing that you're doing, you're not really a fan. I still just, I think that it sort of helps to attack this problem from first principles. It's like, what would fans do? What do fans do? They care about this thing. They're engaged in this game that's happening, right? I think fundamental to that question, the answer to the question, what do fans do? They watch games, right? Like that's what fans do. And so when we have this conversation around like, well, these people don't watch games, I sort of come back and say, well, I'm not sure that they're fans then. And so just imagine this in like a different scenario. Imagine I said, hey, you said Neil or Ben, what's your favorite band? And I said, oh, I'm a huge Beatles fan. And you said, well, what's your favorite Beatles song? Do you have a favorite Beatles album? Have you watched the Beatles documentary? And I said, no, actually, only I follow Paul McCartney on Instagram. He had some cool posts. I can't name you albums. I can't talk to you about songs. I can't talk to you about moments where that song, like reasons that song is meaningful to me. I haven't seen him in concert. I haven't seen all the documentary footage. If I'm not doing all those things, then I can't really say I'm a Beatles
Yeah,
fan. And I think similarly,
you like the chef, but you don't actually eat the
it doesn't make sense. And
food.
so I think, and there's a lot of that with fandom that when we sort of have this conversation where we kind of say stuff. And it doesn't always line up logically, and so I think the reality is fans today have more touch points. If you're an engaged fan, you're going to do more of those things. That's just an expression. That's the action that sort of precedes or comes from the passion. And so I think that's the right way to be thinking about it. I think there's another kind of thread here that we can pull on, which is, generally, there is the sort of industry standard is to have a take of fandom as verticalized, right? So we think of NFL fans, and that's a distinct group from MLB fans, and that's a distinct group from WNBA fans, and that's a distinct group from NBA fans. And the reality is that fandom in this country is it's much more helpful and accurate to think about it as a horizontal thing. So as opposed to saying, hey, there's 80 million NFL fans and 60 million MLB fans, and like on the line. Really, the way that I think about it is there's roughly 120 million fans in the fan universe across the entire spectrum of engagement in this country today, 18 plus. I'd say probably 40 million of them, 35 million of them are very engaged. I'd say another 35 million aren't very engaged, and then there's the rest in the middle. And the people who are most engaged in sort of my definition of fandom here, which is comprised of how these people engage across the big six sports. So that's NFL, NBA, MLB, NHL, college basketball, college football, men's college basketball. The people who are the most engaged using those sports as the criteria to define high engagement, those people are the most likely to engage with the next sport. And in fact, the more sports you add to someone's repertoire as a fan, the more likely they are to be a fan of the next sport. So this is true across everything from the World Cup to the WNBA to women's college basketball to World Surf League to rugby union. Think of fandom as a muscle, and you've built this muscle, and you have all these social networks that are activated by this thing that's part of your identity. And now I've introduced a new thing to you, new game, right? Caitlin Clark, people are talking about Caitlin Clark on SportsCenter. She's sort of taking the world by storm. The people who are going to respond to that are people that are already in this space, gobbling all of this stuff up because their identity and their social networks are activated by that thing. It's not reaching. So the there are some new people that come into the fan universe when we start to introduce new sports, new demographics, and so on and so forth. So the exact demographic of an audience for a WNBA game compared to an NBA game, it's not perfect, but it's mostly comprised of the same people. People who are growing and driving the growth in the WNBA consumption are probably NBA fans. And they're probably also the ones who are most likely to be watching college men's basketball, college women's basketball. They're the ones that are going to run the March Madness pool in their office. They're the ones that are going to have a fantasy basketball team. Those are the people that are most likely to be watching more WNBA. It's not some new group of people that we're bringing to the table. And so I think that that's kind of a helpful reorientation for people to really maybe better understand how fandom operates.
And is that how, like, when you find that in real life, right, and through your research and through like data and whatnot, like those polyamorous fans, for lack of a better term, like is that more what we should be going after? Like it's easier to turn someone who's already a fan of NFL, NBA, MLB, turn them into an IndyCar fan, as opposed to trying to find someone who, like, I assume there are those whatever mono sport fans who are just diehard. And like it always astounds me when like someone is. We're walking around on a crazy NFL Sunday, and they're a sports fan, and yet they don't even care of ever watch an NFL game, and they live in the States or whatever. And so, like, are those more the exceptions to the rule when they're just, solely focused on whatever NASCAR and don't care about stick and ball sports, for example?
So this is like it's helpful to kind of bring TV in here because when we think about ratings, so I work for a TV network first and foremost. When you think about how to grow ratings are comprised of three elements. There's the reach, the duration. So it's how many people watch. That's the reach. The duration is how long did they watch. The frequency is how often do they watch. You can grow the rating, the actual the currency of the business, what we transact on, by growing any three of those elements, right? It's much easier to get someone who's already in the tent, who's already got the TV on the NFL game, to watch longer, to watch the first quarter of the next game, right? That's a much easier proposition than trying to convince someone who doesn't engage with the NFL to watch one game. That idea of going from zero to one is
Totally.
really difficult, right? Going from three to four, relatively much easier. And so I think the same logic applies then when we think about someone's fan repertoire. They're sort of like the sports that they're into. The more sports they have in that, the more likely they are to bring on a new one. More is more. Fans love more
So
sports. They want to engage.
you don't have a fixed capacity of the number of sports you can follow. I mean, I assume the avidity levels can only be so strong across a certain number of sports.
I mean, maybe. Sure. Yes, that's probably true. There is some sort of like theoretical ceiling you could hit, where you don't have more time in the day. I'm not sure that that's like a useful way to think about this, because I don't think we've ever gotten close to wringing the most possible engagement out of the people who are already most engaged. So another way to think about that, We look at frequency of NFL viewing. We'll use Nielsen to do this. The top 20% of NFL viewers throughout the season watch on average three games per week. Now, they have available to them, if they're just a normal a pay TV bundle subscriber, they have at least six games available to them to watch, right? They're on Prime, right? So you've got a lot more football to watch. For the most engaged fans, they could watch 50% more, right? But they don't. So I just don't know that we're really like at the limit of fan engagement in a way that talking about like the ceiling of this is useful. It's kind of like a theoretical end state, but it's not really the reality. And so the more we so when you think of like so come back to like the motorsport, like the let's talk IndyCar. Fox is has a relationship with IndyCar, and what we talk about a lot with Indy is the way to grow the Indy pie is to first and foremost get people who are already in the Indy tent to watch longer and more often. Just watch one more race. That's actually the easiest way to do it. The next rung out is let's talk to motorsport fans who are not watching IndyCar yet. That's the next one. Then we go out from there. Now it's just fans who are less into motorsports, more into the other stick and ball sports, as you put it. They haven't really fully been converted to truly being avid, engaged motorsport fans or indie fans. That's the next most likely group of people that we can pull from. Trying to convince someone who's just like not into sports and not into motorsports specifically that they should like motorsports is a really tall task. It's just really hard.
And
And
yet,
so,
if go ahead, Ben.
no, go ahead.
No, I was say, and yet it feels like so much of sports marketing is focused on growing that top of the funnel, trying to find the next, heated rivalry that's going to bring in someone who's never thought about watching hockey, but now is going to watch hockey, or is, going to come in through some creator that is whatever, a fashion creator, a food creator, and they're going to bring in someone who's like. Is that a naive way to go about it? And should we be thinking more about how do we get the quote unquote, I guess, the median fan to be more like the top 20% fan?
It's not so much I wouldn't say it's a naive way. I think it's maybe an unrealistic way. So I think the reality is that we're talking about companies with finite resources, right? And so it's not that you wouldn't want to convert those people to becoming fans. Like you wouldn't want to go from the top of the funnel to the bottom of the funnel. Yes. I guess what I'm suggesting is it's really hard to do that. It requires a lot of resources and your failure rate is going to be pretty high relative to the other options you have strategically. And so if you had infinite resources, yes, you would deploy all of this
Yeah,
to try and
shotgun.
convert the world to be a fan of your team, league, whatever it might be. That's not reality. The reality is you have finite resources. And so what I would suggest is, and so this is a conversation we could have, we can go back to the IndyCar example. It's you have finite resources. Let's focus here first on the lowest hanging fruit, and then the next rung out, and then the next rung out. Now, if we have resources left over, great. Let's try and do those things you described, but let's not get ahead of ourselves. Let's not spread the resources around so thin that we're not actually being effective. Let's try and focus the resources where we convert the highest potential conversion group, and then we move on to the next one. Only when once we've satisfied that.
No, it totally makes sense. It more efficient, get the best bang for your buck, so to speak. And, so, and it ties into something I want to talk about next too, which is, and you mentioned this, in passing multiple times now around like, who is that person's going to run the March Madness pool? Who's the person that's going to start the fantasy league and recruit others? And like, I think about whatever Malcolm Gladwell tipping point type people. Like, I forget the terminology that he might have used, but like who's going to be that evangelist among your fans? Is going to recruit the others? Is going to say, "Hey, you guys want to go to a race this Sunday? You guys want to go to a baseball game tonight? Like, let's do that. We got nothing else to do." Like, how do you identify those fans? And is that a key growth point among your existing fan base to say, "Hey, like, let's try to develop more fan evangelists because they're going to be more effective, word of mouth, et cetera, and they're going to bring their social circles into our fan ecosystem."
I don't have a good answer for how to identify them. I mean, I'm sure there's some sort of like psychographic markers you can go find to try and like put those people in a bucket and target them potentially, right? Like that's an idea. I think maybe the easier way to think about that question is to think about how to make the process of doing that thing, whatever the thing is in question,
Remove
right?
friction.
Setting up the pool, getting the group together for tickets. How do you remove friction to the process, right? So that's I think that that's like it, just personally, we've talked about I have a season ticket relationship with the Los Angeles Clippers. This is a personal thing. I take my son. I've been able, because they have a program that's pretty easy, it's pretty user-friendly, it's specifically targeted at bringing kids. It's been much easier for me, who's not typically like the evangelist here, to say, hey, you other families who might be interested in this from the Pee-wee basketball team, give this a look. Like you might like it. We could all go together. They made it easy for me to do that. And so I think it's probably just again, a better, more efficient use of resources. If you just focus on how do we decrease friction from this process, as opposed to saying, how do we find people who are willing to overcome friction? That's just like a, it's like a tougher putt. And I think reframing it this way is probably a more effective way to approach this, tactically, like day to day in the real world.
And it ties into what you were talking about earlier as well, of like, we can try to let's go after the fan who is coming to a game with two people. Can we get them to come to a game with a third person, or bring someone they haven't brought before? And that's gonna be easier than trying to find someone who's never been to a game, or trying to find a let alone a group, or find someone to recruit people who go from 0 games to 5, 6 games, whatever it might be. No, it makes a lot of sense there. I also want
I've
to
been
touch
having a
on.
lot of conversations with MLB lately, and a lot of really smart folks over there, and I think that they're approaching this problem in a really smart way, and they are the ones that kind of introduce that 0-1 or 1-2 framework to me, and so give credit to those folks, but effectively saying they want to try and increase the repeat visit to the ballpark in within a season. That's a much easier thing to do. Requires less resources. You have a higher probability of success than trying to go from 0-1. And so I think if you just like take that framework and you apply it to a lot of these different problems, it can be illuminating into just where you should, put your resources.
Totally. No, and it's very germane right now as we think of as all these MLS teams and to NWSL teams are trying to find a way to use this World Cup momentum to create more fans, to drive more attendance. And I think a lot of them are doing this like first game on us promotion, where if you haven't been to a game before, you can sign up and get tickets to a first game. And I've said that's great, but then the most important thing is get them to come back. How do you get them to come to a second game? Because that's the most, that's going to get someone to actually commit a little bit more, and go beyond just that initial touch point, which, especially if it's free, it's going to be a little bit easier. So I think that's really astute. You mentioned too, like the kids element. I think we spend a lot of time thinking about, whether I'm sure you have much more knowledge than I do about like the magic age, whatever. It's like some it might say, 9 years old, 10 years old, 8 years old, whatever it is. And when someone develops that potentially lifelong fandom, like, have you found that the ways that people are developing fans, the way that fandom gets developed, like is age a really big thing? Is life stage a really big thing? What have you found? Like, I mean, you mentioned, going with your son, like having kids is another, impetus to start to find other ways to connect, whether it's with you and your kid, or with you and other kids, or you and other families rather, with kids as well. So like, is it right for us to try to really spend a lot of time and effort focused on developing those youth fans in hopes that it's gonna create longer lifetime and more important valuable lifetime value, as opposed to going after those fans who maybe have more disposable income, or looking for a different type of experience?
This is a really important question, and there's a bunch of things we could touch on here. I think the short answer to the question is yes. It's critically important to think about the next generation of fans and finding those people when they're kids. There's no magic age per se. I've seen different data sets kind of point to, you need to have people in the tent before they're 12, before they're 16, before they're 18. I generally buy it. I think like younger is better. But I think it's important to one is to recognize that adult fandom does not look like kid fandom. So I think a lot of times what's taken hold in this conversation is like, oh, kids these days, they root for players, not teams. They only watch highlights. They can't sit through a game. They do all of these things that to a 40-year-old seem like they're not really big fans. And that's because they're not, by comparison to a 40-year-old, really big fans. Like, this is a thing, this is an activity that you are socialized into. It takes years, if not decades, to really reach peak fandom. And so to compare a 40-year-old's engagement to a 20-year-old's engagement to a 10-year-old's engagement and say, oh, I'm going to complain about, like, if they're not engaged, if a 10-year-old's not engaging like a 40-year-old, then they're lost. It's just it's kind of to sort of miss the way that this actually operates and takes root in
Yeah.
someone's life. And so that's really important, I think, to understand. Two, I think it's really important for kids, and I think the way to think about this, especially if you're a parent, but even if you're not a parent, if you're sort of just operating the business, is that I think we have to recognize that fandom is a learned behavior that requires repetition over time. Right? Learned behavior, parents should model this thing, and it requires repetition. So it's not watching one game one time. It's not watching a couple games a few times. It's watching hundreds of games over decades together.
Yeah.
Because the important part here is the repetition, but that behavior that you're modeling is stickiest when it's done in the context of family bonding rituals. Right? So when I invite my kid in to watch with me and hang out, when it becomes something that we do with friends and family, the reason that we get together, right? When we do that repeatedly over the years, it becomes just what our family does. That's actually how fandom takes root in a kid's life. That's really the key moments are there in the living room with the family.
Yeah.
They're
I
in the
grew up
stadium
watching the
with them.
Cowboys on Thanksgiving with my family. Yeah.
Yes, that's where it takes root. Now it starts to spread very, very quickly. It starts to spread. They start to do things among themselves, the kids, right? So my son is a good example here. I have made it a priority that he gets as many reps doing this thing that we do. We watch games, we go to games, we talk about games as much as possible in a variety of circumstances. He's really into basketball. Great. We'll kind of follow that. I also like basketball. No surprise, he's more into basketball because I am into basketball. It's kind of how this works. You
Yeah.
sort of inherit that. I think eventually he will get into the other football, soccer. He started to show some interest there. It starts to kind of bud and sort of take root. Now his friends are sort of talking about it. He asks practically, can I join the Little League team? Now we're talking about baseball. D the Dodgers have been introduced to the conversation in addition to the Clippers. Now they are doing, with the dad's help, we have the basketball team and the baseball team shares a lot of the same kids. We now have a kid dad fantasy football league. We're in our third year.
Yeah.
Now that's being so those are all the different repetitions that they require over the years to then share this thing, not just with their family, but with their friends, to then start to relate to other people outside of their kind of circle through these means, through this guy, like this fan lens. That's how this takes root. There is no other way to convert a kid to be a fan than the process I just described. Everything else will never be as effective as the thing I just told you. That's how this works, right? And so then again, you're socialized into this over the years, and so you become peak fandom, as we've measured it, that where we have the highest incidence of the most engaged fans is around 40, 39, somewhere in there, 39, 30, 40, 41, right? Not coincidentally, the average age that an American adult man in this country has their first child is 29. So again, not coincidentally, when you have a 10-year-old in your living room, it happens to be when you, the adult, reach peak fandom. That is not a coincidence. That's because we share these things together. That's
Yeah.
how this works, right? And so I think, again, we come back, like, what are the implications of this for the business? How do we think about making the team, the league, the game, the centerpiece of family bonding rituals? How do we make that easier to do more often? And then the process just starts to take on a life of its own.
Yeah. No, I love this stuff, man. A few minutes left here with Ben Valente, EVP of Strategy Analytics for Fox Sports. I can keep you all day. We'll go a few more minutes here, but there's a couple avenues I want to jump off of from that discussion there. One that you and I have touched on in the past is around connecting participation and fandom, and I think NFL is a great example because it's the most popular sport in the United States by a significant margin, I'd say, and yet the average American has not played tackle football, most likely. Maybe we played a little bit. I played when I was a kid. I probably suffered some mild concussions back in the day, but but regardless of the fact that like A lot of people watch that sport and care about it, but have never played it. And that's the NFL thesis, perhaps, is that's why we need to get more footballs in hands and flag football, and that's going to lead to more people that are being fans. And so, is there a dichotomy of like, or is it one and the same almost of fans of a sport that will also become fans of the organized sport, of the team, the brand, the league, the professional aspect of it? That's the TV program, I guess you could say, that it happens to be that sport that they also play. Like, is that one and the same almost, or is there different pathways that are through participation versus through this is entertaining and it's a part of my social circle?
It's really important. I think participation is a key on-ramp to fandom. As much as that's true, I think maybe one way to kind of reframe this is to think about youth sports participation as much as it is like an influence of fandom, it's also a manifestation of fandom, right? Like what we find is that the kids who are playing a sport, their parents played that sport and are fans of that sport. So very much play is parent led, right? And so I think it's important to sort of think about like the implications of that for the sort of like the fan side of the business. Because we want more kids to play, because the more kids that play, that is one of those on-ramps to fandom. So I think it's like take sort of like zooming out one step further. So yes, fandom is an on-ramp to our participation is an on-ramp to fandom. But we should think about participation through this lens of fandom, especially adult parent fandom, because that's how we can unlock this. And at the end of the day, so I think that there is a direct relationship between playing a sport and then following that sport specifically. So playing tackle football and then becoming an NFL fan. You like kind of go a step further in something like flag football would be like adjacent to tackle football, but it's fundamentally the same game. So you have that like clearer pathway. I think there's also just we should be thinking about this more expansively to just playing sports. Again, playing sports as a kid is a manifestation of fandom. Playing sports kind of puts you in this world where you are using sports to socialize and interact with other people, peers, coaches, other parents, your parents, etc. Right? So sports become this like this thing that you bond around, right? So you get in the habit of doing that with a team. But sure, as you like, sure enough, as you are in the dugout at Little League, waiting for your turn to bat, you're talking about what's going on the field. You're talking about, you're goofing around with your friends, but you're also talking about the Dodgers or the Padres or whoever the local team is or what. And so all of a sudden, this participation thing starts to bleed into this fan experience thing, and they start to like become hard to pull apart. And I think that's really like what's going on here. And then eventually you're going to retire, right? So you get in the habit of using sports as a way to connect. You start connecting about the game and your participation in the game and how you're developing as an athlete. That also bleeds into how you're thinking about this as a fan. And then eventually you're going to retire. And now what's left is you have that sort of like fan muscle built up. And so I think that's like how the process works. But I think there's a lot of nuance in terms of like how we think about that, because part of where I'm going here, part of the point is, once you sort of learn that process and you start to build that muscle, it doesn't matter that you grew up playing basketball and baseball and soccer. You are now going to be the one that will join the fantasy football league, right? Like you've just kind of built this muscle up, and there's going to be a lot of overlap with your social networks. They're going to also be watching the NFL and college football. And then as a result of that, it's going to pull you into that world, right? And so I think, yes, it's more likely that if you play a sport, you're going to follow that sport. It's more likely that if you played sports, even not the sport in question, you're going to be a fan of that sport, right? And so I think it's really important that we think about ways to get more kids involved. This is a very much a it has like a there's a business objective here about growing the next generation of consumers. Yes, of course. I also think that like the data that we have around the benefits for kids to participating in sports is incontrovertible. There is no question that there's no other activity out there that kids can do that has a positive impact on their mental health and their wellness outcomes than playing in sports, number one, and then being a fan of sports, number two. Like those are the most important things. So even if you just looked at this from like a social good perspective, getting more kids to play sports should be a number one priority for all of us in this industry, but really as a society.
And it's a great point for us to to wind down here, because some of the key things in your research stuff that you and I have talked about as well is just the idea. And something that was really cool for me to learn is If you are a fan of something already, you're more likely to become a fan of something else. And like you said, it's a muscle. It's something that you're just more prone to do it. And so, mixing fandoms, I guess, come into play. But like ultimately, too, it's like why are people fans? And that's like the crux of this whole conversation, I guess. Is like why be a fan? And like the answer that I always come to, and I want to hear you touch on this as well, is an excuse to socialize. I mean, to put it in stark terms, like when something happens, it's a crazy NBA trade happens, Kawhi Leonard gets traded. Now I can text you and be like, "Yo, sucks for your Clippers or whatever," or "Good luck with Brandon Ingram," or my college team has a big game. I can text my college buddies and be like, "Did you see this? I just happened yesterday, actually, a big crazy story in Yale athletics." And so like, when we talk about why be a fan, and the idea of like, your next fan is already a fan of something else already. Like, how do you lean into that? Like, are these the key insights that you have found as well? And like, what are the implications for it in an actionable sense?
I think that I think why people engage it's an excuse to hang out. Like, yes, I think that's like one way to say it. I
Conversation
think
starter.
I it's a thing that facilitates social interaction.
Yeah.
Like, that's what it is, right? That's why ultimately, underneath all of our fan engagement activities, why we do those things individually comes down to the fact that it's a thing we do with other people, and doing stuff with other people is fun. And this is just a fun world to be in. And
Yeah.
we go on this emotional ride. We celebrate, we commiserate together. The together part is the most important thing. And so I think that that ultimately is what motivates fan engagement. It's the benefit of fan engagement as well. Like, depending on how you want to think about it, you can kind of go both ways. The reason that we engage as fans is because we can use this thing to connect to other people. It's a thing that operates in our life to build a social infrastructure, a robust, healthy, strong social infrastructure around which we can scaffold on a lot of relationships and
Yeah.
interactions. And you can sort of see it in sort of deep, meaningful ways. I shared this previously. My dad is, and I, like, what we talk about primarily is the Denver Broncos. And if we didn't have the Denver Broncos, we wouldn't talk anywhere near as often. We wouldn't enjoy the conversations anywhere near as much. And our relationship would lose something if we
Yeah.
didn't have that thing that connects us. So that's a deep, meaningful, profound relationship for me. It's also like I invited last night for the Mexico-Ecuador World Cup game. I invited somebody who I've only hung out with a couple times. It's really easy to do that. It would have been weird, not weird, awkward, hard, uncomfortable. There'd been friction in the process. Had I just said, "Hey, dude, we haven't hung out that much. Why don't you come over and hang out
Right.
with the family?"
Yeah.
It would have been a much harder socially situation to put both of us in to do that. It was easy because I was like, "Hey, come watch the game."
Yeah.
And then I invited another person over, and all of a sudden we had five people in the garage, new friends, old friends, my father-in-law. We're all hanging out. We're watching the game. Kids are popping in. They're hanging out for a bit, then they kind of like lose interest and go out. That's okay. They sort of see this behavior modeled. Like,
Yeah.
that's really what this is about. It's easy for me to signal this thing. I brought in today the U.S. men's national team plays Bosnia in the round of 32 in the World Cup. I brought in this hat. I guess what? I wear this hat around today. I'm gonna get a lot of like, "Go USA,"
Hell yeah.
right? That's really good for us. Like literally, there's been sociologists who have measured how that changes their hormonal balance in our system. It releases oxytocin. We are happier as a result of having interactions like that with strangers.
Yeah.
It's just this thing that kind of like operates around us. It's very easy to signal, operates at a scale that allows for us to connect. And because of those connections, fans are happier, more satisfied with their life, more confident, more optimistic, more likely to give to charity. There's a whole host of wellness outcomes that are improved by engaging as a fan. Not because sports teaches us some lesson, not because there's some like sort of like magic wand that sports can wave, but literally just because it invites us and makes easy connecting with other people. And because we're social creatures, we want to connect with other people. And so we are happier as a result of all that connecting.
Yeah, I want to say Mike Troplin's got some terrible stat, but I want to touch on one more thing because I'm remiss if I didn't ask about it. Because this podcast originally started around talking about digital and social, so I want to touch on social media and how that comes into play as well. Especially in terms of like, is that same experience just as powerful and strong with a social network, with a faceless network, I guess you could say. Like if I'm watching, I don't have a lot of friends who are PWHL fans, but I watch PWHL games, and I try to find community where I can on Reddit, on Twitter, wherever it might be. Like, is that are those signals and is that social glue just as strong, or is there something different around trying to find your family on these digital and social platforms?
It's not as strong. It's not bad necessarily, but it's not as strong. I think the way to think about this, like put this into like when sociologists look at this, like they describe like two different types of connections. You have strong tie connections and weak tie connections. Strong tie connections are, your family, your spouse, your partner, your closest friends. And then like fan engagement, there's sort of a spectrum that goes out from there. And then there's at a certain point there's a line you cross over into weak tie interactions. Those are
Yeah.
people that you don't know, but you might recognize. This is like, think of like the barista that you see every day. You say hello, it's a
Right.
familiar face, you don't know their name, right? But it's a warm interaction. That's a weak tie interaction.
Yeah.
I would put that community you're trying to find online most likely somewhere like on the periphery of that weak tie group, right?
Yeah.
It's good if you can find connection that way. It's going to incentivize you to engage more as a fan. Yes. It's nowhere near as meaningful and deep and profound as the strong tie interactions.
Yeah, it's a
And
community,
so,
but it's a third degree community, I guess you could say, or whatever. And it's still nice to feel like you're not watching alone, but it's
yeah.
not the same as like having a friendship group that is based off of that a little bit.
Exactly. And there's value to that. I mean, we think about this a lot, like in terms of like going to a stadium. And there's the people you sit around. Right? Like if you're a season ticket holder, you got to get to know the people in your section.
Yeah.
You know the ushers, right? You know those people. That's really important to you. That's a community. There's also just the experience all the way, if you zoom all the way out, to just being part of the crowd. Right? They call that collective effervescence.
Totally.
That's kind of what like going on Twitter X, like when a big moment happens.
Yeah.
Tonight when USA plays Bosnia, there's going to be this really active conversation that's happening online. Like you can plug into that and you can feel that. Sort of like the digital version of that collective effervescence.
Yeah.
It's nowhere near as powerful as the collective effervescence experience in real life in the stadium.
Right.
And that's nowhere near as powerful as like really being with your like on the couch next to your best buds, your kids, your parents, experiencing that moment.
Yeah.
And there's just degrees to this. I think it's helpful to just sort of be realistic about how deep those ties can go.
Yeah.
Online versus in real life.
So many more things we had to talk about, Ben, but we'll have some more fun in our quick hitting question segment, which I've titled More Friends. First episode of Shareable Stat coming up right now. Just incredible stuff with Ben Valenta, again, SVP of Strategy Analytics for Fox Sports and co-author of the book Fans Have More Friends. Just tremendous, tremendous stuff. I enjoyed every ounce of it. But stick around because we're going to have more fun with Ben in our quick hitting question segment. You definitely want to hear that. Some great, great additional insights and maybe one of my favorite anecdotes I've ever heard on this podcast. It's one that I want to listen to again and again, goosebumps inducing. But first, we have this episode's shareable stat. And I pulled a stat that's very relevant to this conversation we're having today. And that is coming off an S&P Global U.S. Consumer Insight Survey in late 2025. So not 2026, but late 2025, so close enough. And this survey found that on average, fans at both avid fans and casual fans are a fan of additional around 2.5 to 2.7 sports. Casual fans were an average of 2.4. Avid fans of a given sport were watched an average of 2.7 sports. So what does it mean? It means that they're on average, most fans are definitely fans of more than one sport, if not two, if not three. And of course, that's only the average. So there's certainly some with four or five who say they are fans of more than one, more than two, more than even three or four sports. And so as Ben was talking about in the interview, and again, you'll hear more in the next segment, fandom truly is a muscle. If you are a fan of something, you are more likely to become a fan of something else. You understand it. It's another avenue for belonging, as we talked about as well. And it's a way to think about how you market to fans also. Yes, we there's still benefit to going to more of the lifestyle verticals, the people who have never thought to watch a sport before, and maybe you can get them to discover your sport and become a fan that way. And it certainly helps if you are attacking fans who are fans of something else already, whether it's a sport or not. But the low-hanging fruit, as Ben talked about in the interview, and as we went through throughout that, is that Your low-hanging fruit is the current fans of other sports. They're more likely, they know how to, it's like, riding a bike or whatever it might be. You know how to be a fan. You know what fans do. And so you're a fan of something else, you're more likely to become a fan of something else, of another sport. Whether that is, making sure that you try to get fans who are looking for a summer sport to get behind, or introduce them to a new sport that can be a good complement to their current sport, or of course the localized fandom as well, of trying to make sure that if you're a fan of this local basketball team, you're also gonna be a fan of the local football team and the baseball team and the hockey team and the women's basketball team and the women's soccer team and the men's soccer team and all, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So really interesting shareable stat. Again, that stat comes from an S&P Global US Consumer Insight survey from late 2025 that said, on average, avid fans watch 2.7 professional sports leagues and casual fans watch 2.4. So pretty close there, not a huge difference whether it's casual or avid. But the fact is, a fan of one sport is pretty likely to be a fan of two or three or four sports as well. So think about it, talk about it, ponder it. More importantly, stick around because more good stuff coming with Ben Valenta of Fox Sports and the co-author of Fans Have More Friends. Right back with this episode's Shareable Stat, and I'm joined once again by Ben Valenta. He is the EVP of Strategy Analytics at Fox Sports, also the co-author of Fans Have More Friends. Check out that book. Ben, you kicked ass interview. Are you now ready to find some more friends?
I'm ready.
All right, number one. I had to bring this one up because I saw recently that Heineken has a brand campaign called "Fans Have More Friends." What'd you think when you saw that tagline? And also, I guess more generally, tell us just what the process is like of writing the book "Fans Have More Friends."
Well, so we wrote the book. Oh gosh, it's probably been 4 years now.
Yeah, 22.
And just I think we were sort of circling around some of these ideas. We kept kind of seeing the patterns emerge in the data, and eventually, when we got to the wellness outcomes, when it was not just that fans had more friends, but that actually makes their lives measurably better, that's when we realized it was a book, and we just kind of like started that process. And then somewhere along the way, some folks from Heineken, it's actually probably Heineken's agency, ad agencies, reached out and they said, "Hey, we're sort of interested in this insight. Would you be up for a conversation?" We had a couple of conversations. And then they came back and said, "Hey, we're actually interested in using the title of the book as a line
Oh wow, I
for
did
the."
not know it was done over above board. That's incredible.
Yeah, no, they were great to work with, and everything was done above board, and they kind of came to us and got our blessing to use the line, and we've done some work with them and are researching the idea, and been a little bit of part of the launch of the campaign. So it's been great. We love to sort of see the work out there in the world, and to see how they captured the ideas. In ways that only advertising can do, right? It can be very useful way to communicate ideas. And so yeah, great work.
That is awesome, and yeah, it's conveying the insight that you guys found, which is that fans do have more friends, and among other wellness outcomes, that's fantastic. Number two, you talked about working in the agency space, but before you got to Fox Sports, I know you spent a lot of time at an agency called Sterling, which is a really well-respected brand agency. So tell me the most memorable project or brand campaign or initiative that you worked on while you were there.
I think my favorite one was we worked on. I worked on a bunch of clients that were in the sports space. We did a lot of work with like the New York Knicks, New York Rangers. We did some work with the NFL, a handful of other teams across the NHL, NFL. The Knicks work was definitely my favorite, but I think like the most memorable project I worked on was for the Visitor Bureau of Branson, Missouri, which is an Ozark Lake of the Ozarks destination. And we worked with the Visitor Bureau to try and sort of unlock a positioning that would sort of help them attract more visitors. And so that was a very unique, it was unique because of the stakeholders involved,
Yeah.
definitely like a very unique client, and the outcomes were really good actually too.
I may be wrong here, but when I hear Branson, Missouri, I think there's a Simpsons reference where it's like Las Vegas if Ned Flanders ran it.
That's pretty good distillation of it actually. Yeah.
Oh, that's incredible. Number three, tell me the book besides yours, besides Fans More Friends, that you recommend the most or has stuck with you the most.
Good question.
Take your time.
I think the one that I would recommend is there's one by Ezra Klein called Why We're Polarized. So as we were doing like writing our own book, we were researching a lot of the topics, And then through the process of doing research on those topics, reading a lot of books, like I would say sort of like in the genre of kind of nonfiction, that's sort of explaining a sort of a sociological phenomenon, describing data, articulating a clear point of view, making a case, using data. And I think that that book did a really good job at not only helping us kind of understand some of the topics we were working on, but also being a good kind of like North Star for how to write about such material.
Yeah.
And so that was really useful.
Ah, good call there. I'm sure you guys had a really interesting reading list that I wouldn't mind perusing one of these days. Number four, I'm curious where you're gonna go with this one. Tell me the major sport. You can use major however you interpret it. The major sport with the highest avidity median fan. If you were to take a fan, pluck a fan who's like the median fan out of the sport, they are most likely to have the highest avidity compared to their counterparts in other sports.
Good question. I think some of the more niche sports that demand more effort, time, consideration on behalf of the fans, they probably have, I mean, they definitionally have a smaller fan base.
Right.
But the people in there, and so I'm thinking of something like, I don't know, like World Surf League, I think is a good example. Like the people that I know who are into World Surf League are really into World Surf League.
Right.
Now, importantly, they are also into other sports. Like
Yeah.
they're people that I also watch NBA finals games with and am in fantasy football leagues with. So like it's not that they're only devoted to that one thing, but I think if they add something like that to their portfolio, then when it comes to that particular sport, they have to work really hard to do it, and they're really into it as a result.
Without explanation, just whatever pops in your head first. Like, what about the big six that you mentioned earlier? Which do you think would fall in that category, the highest median avidity fan?
It would probably be, I would probably be like Major League Baseball, kind of somewhere in the middle. It's not
That sounds about right.
like it's not the smallest, but it definitely, like, because of the commitment required across the season,
Yeah.
that'd be probably my guess.
Yeah, well, and plus you
I
watch
but I
them.
imagine that, like, I think maybe a better answer is that they probably look a lot more similar than different. I think the NFL casts the widest net, and so you probably have the lowest average, just by like the math of it. But I would imagine, like, at the end of the day, all the sports in question, because again, they're drawing from a lot of the same people, they
Right.
probably look pretty similar.
No, that's a question we could spend days debating with no clear answer necessarily, but a fun barroom barbershop debate.
Yep.
Number five for you, coming down here with Ben Valente of Fox Sports and Fans and More Friends. Tell me the most memorable or surprising aha or insight that you found in your time at Fox Sports. Some of the research focuses that you've done there. What's something that made you stop and go, "Wow, I learned that today, or today I learned, or whatever. That's interesting."
I think honestly, like we've talked about it already, I think it was when we got to the wellness outcomes. I think that was the there was a pivot that we had to make where we went from like, oh, we are kind of practitioners, we have like a consultant mind, and we come to this and we kind of attack this problem. We're like thinking about like, why do people do what they do? Oh, this is kind of interesting. Here's some insights, here's some patterns that emerge. And then you get to, I think we have an understanding of how fandom works, to, I think this is actually the key to improving society. And there's a moment of conversion that happened, and it was probably when we saw the first results from just a simple happiness questionnaire that came back with a very discernible, clear pattern. The bigger the fan, the happier.
Yeah.
And then that like led to, okay, we've now t I don't even know how many wellness outcomes we've actually run through surveys. I mean, I would say it's probably like in the 30s at this point. Literally every time we see something come out, like on Pew Research, we'll tweet something about like, here, the American Time Use Survey just came out. We'll, pull something from there. Every time it comes back the exact same. But that the first time we did that was when we went from, oh, this is a cool industry insight, to, oh, this is actually something we should be thinking about, in terms of bettering society, improving democracy. This can actually like be used as a tool to solve things like the loneliness crisis.
Yeah.
That's kind of like a conversion point for us.
That's freaking awesome. Love it. It's super inspiring too. And it makes you feel good about, working in the space over the years and caring about it. Number six for you. Tell me, this is meant to be open-ended for you. Tell me the underrated or underappreciated metric in sports media. You know, we talked about Nielsen a little bit, other things as well. What's the most underrated, unappreciated metric in sports media, in your opinion, whatever pops in your head?
Oh, I think it's I mean, I think we spent a lot of time talking about reach, and rightfully so. I mean, I think especially when we're talking about like the media environment, reach is really important. For me, the thing, again, kind of coming back to like some of the themes from the beginning of the conversation, to me, the thing that I pay most attention to is duration, right? Duration and then frequency. Like those are the two things. So I spent a lot of time thinking about like our daily studio talk shows, right? So like your Colin Cowherd
Yeah,
type
versus
programming. The number one metric I pay the most attention to is time spent viewing. How long is a typical session spent watching Colin Cowherd? And when that's going up, that is a sign that they're on the right track, doing the right thing, producing great content. When it's going down, when it's starting to soften, that's a sign that maybe something needs to be like perfected around the edges. Those guys are great at doing what they do. But that's the thing I think that reveals the most about how fans are engaging with the content.
Yeah, love that. It's a great one. I certainly agree as well. Next one for you coming down the wire here. Tell me the non-sports fan base that most intrigues you and why. We've talked to you and I offline a little bit around like BTS and Taylor Swift and the Beehive and among others as well. What's the non-sports fan base that you look at and go, I want to study that.
It's funny. I mean, we've definitely used Taylor Swift in actual qualitative studies, and to kind of like understand that as a phenomenon. We've looked at like sort of like Marvel movies, Star Wars fans, like that as a phenomenon as well. I have come to think about fandom in this way, is like all of this stuff is kind of working the same way.
Yeah, same
The same sort of mechanics are in play. But they don't reach the same fever pitch because the same sort of structure is not there as with sports.
yeah.
So sure, like Taylor Swift a couple summers ago, like took the world by storm with the tour, and we'll probably do that again. And maybe again after that, and maybe tours till she's 60, and in ripe old age, a la some of these other like rock acts that are still hanging around. Even if that's the case, it's not happening every year.
Yeah.
It's not happening multiple times a year. You can't signal it as easy. You can't engage with it kind of like in alternative ways, a lot like a fantasy league. And so like none of it is ever going to kind of reach that same level as sports, the scale
Yeah.
of sports, because it just doesn't operate with the same structure. And so I think that all of these different communities are interesting in their own right. They all operate with the same basic mechanics. And none of them reach the same sort of heights as sports fandom, and I think that's like the key takeaway for me.
Yeah, fascinating insight there for sure. All right, Ben, it's time for our food question. I always ask a food question. Tell me the best meal to get in LA and where to get it.
The best meal to get in
If I come up
LA and
there and tell you, take me out for a good meal, the best meal you can possibly get, where are we going? What are we ordering?
oh, I love a place in I live in Venice Ramen, second location outside of Tokyo. Fantastic. That's probably where I'm taking you. I think what LA excels at is like very, very good kind of hole in the wall, but very well executed food from especially like international cuisines, and that's like a great shining star example of just that.
There we go. I like it. We'll get some ramen. All right, number nine for you coming out of the wire here. Almost done. Tell me your favorite data point or anecdote from Fans and More Friends. I know we talked a lot about it, some of the findings in there. Is there either a data point or an anecdote from talking to someone from the several interviews that you guys did that really sticks in your mind?
Yeah, for me, it's a story in one of the first chapters is Greg Armstrong. He's a Knicks fan, and this kind of predates our time at Fox. We were spending time again. I mentioned we used to work for the New York Knicks, and we were trying to unlock season ticket holders. Like, why do people do that? Why do people buy season tickets? And we were particularly intrigued by this guy who was very dedicated. I think he was like when we talked to him, he's like year 20. I think he's probably now like year 35. And it just didn't make sense to me. Like there was like no rational explanation for why he did what he did, because it was a lot of his disposable income. It was a lot of time to commute to the garden 41, times a year. The team was not good, right? And then you just spent time with him. So like on the basis of rational, the purchase decision. It just didn't make sense to me. And then I would ask him like, why do you do this? And he just didn't have a very satisfying answer because it revolved around a lot of like fan cliches around like, well, we got to support the team and be loyal. And then you just spent some time with him. You know, we went to games with him. We hung out at his house. We hung out at his barber shop. We did all, you know, we went to work with him, like all sorts of stuff. And you just slowly realized, oh, the Knicks actually are the sort of activator of his social networks. They're like, he would walk into the barber shop and the conversation would immediately turn to him and the Knicks. Like everybody kind of knew he was a Knicks guy, and we would all just start talking basketball. He'd walk into the garden and he like knew all the ushers and he knew like people in his section, and they were all friends, and they kept up kind of like on text threads and stuff like outside the garden. But the most revealing thing was when we went to a game with him, and he had to commute from Orange County, New York. So it was like, you know, 90 minutes ish on a good day, drive into the city to go to a game both ways. That's a lot. And we were driving, and at one point he sort of said like, oh, actually this is kind of my favorite part because I get to hang out with my son. So he would go to the games with one of his sons. And this thing that was a, you know, if you analyze this situation rationally, you'd say, oh, that's a bug, right? Like, how do we decrease the friction there, right? Like, and actually it turned into be the key feature. And that's when you realize, oh, we've been thinking about this all wrong. This is actually a way to facilitate. He's buying these tickets, but the tickets are about buying time with his kid. That's actually what he's buying. He's buying time with his kid. And not just time, but like time it's fun that they both want to do. They share this thing. They talk about it all the time outside of the car and the game. But then there's like captive hours that he has with like an adult child to hang out. And you just don't get that. And so I think for us, it reframed the purchase decision here. And this is like kind of the crux of the whole argument that we make, which is sports are entertaining, but we're not selling entertainment, right? Sports are about the business of belonging. What Greg Armstrong was buying when he purchased season tickets year after year after year after year was time with his kids. And that I think is the easiest way to think about what's actually happening with consumers in this space.
Oh man, that's just so powerful. I freaking love that. I just want to listen to that over and over again. That's freaking awesome. All right, Ben, it's your chance now. Take over the podcast. Tell us your social media, or just really just your all-star followers. Tell us, it can be a blogger, a podcast, a newsletter, a Twitter follow. Just tell us who they are and why they were following.
I want to just shout out Todd Rogers. He's a professor at Harvard. He's the Weatherhead Professor of Public Policy at Harvard Kennedy School, to get it officially correct. He and I have been collaborating along with Dave Sikoriak, who's the co-author of Fans Have More Friends and a close colleague. And Fox recently funded at Harvard the Fandom and Social Connection Initiative that Todd's guiding. So I would encourage people to find Todd's work, Todd Rogers. At the Harvard Kennedy School, check out his work and his take on some of these topics because he's really doing a lot to advance the science of fandom.
It's awesome. We'll link them up and put out information in the show notes. And then how about you, Ben? Where can we find you as well as Fans and More Friends across the interwebs?
You can find Fans Have More Friends anywhere you buy books. Fanshavemorefriends.com is the website for more information. And you can follow me on Twitter and LinkedIn just with my name, Ben Valenta.
We'll link up.
And definitely LinkedIn is a good place to find our latest musings on the space.
We will link it up. And Ben, cannot thank you enough for coming on the podcast today and sharing us some of your knowledge and insight and wisdom. I'm energized, inspired. I've had goosebumps multiple times during this conversation, and just cannot thank you enough for coming on and sharing us with such great expertise.
You got it. Hey, thanks for having me.
Thank you so much again to Ben Valenta. Again, he's the SVP of Strategy Analytics for Fox Sports and also the co-author of the book Fans Have More Friends. And as you could tell, just, super insightful, really thoughtful and articulate with this stuff, really knows it, continues to learn and, update his insights and just such good stuff. I know I sure learned a lot. I really enjoyed the conversation. It, reinvigorated my passion for the space and why it's so important to be in sports and how it can help, not just your own social circles, but truly can help society at large. Of treating of having us more treat like a community and connecting with other people and building that social circle, solving the loneliness epidemic, et cetera. So cannot thank Ben enough for coming on the podcast today to share some of his expertise, insights, and wisdom. But that'll do it for this episode of the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast. Thanks again for watching or listening. As always, I'm your trusty host, Neil Horowitz. You can find me on Twitter, NJ27, also on LinkedIn, where I'd love to connect with you there and see more of my content. The website where you can find the whole archive and more content is dsmsports.net. And check out the podcast, subscribe, follow along, look for clips on your preferred podcast platform. Until next time, this is Neil Horowitz signing off for the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast.